The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, because we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. It's no surprise that everyone on the Skeptically Speaking team is quite enamored with research of all sorts. On last week's episode, we spoke with cognitive psychologist Barb Drescher about bad research. And this week, keeping with the theme, we'll be discussing improbable research with Mark Abrams, one of the founders of the Ig Nobel Prizes. For those who don't know, the Ig Nobels honor achievements that first make people laugh and then make them think. The prizes are intended to celebrate the unusual, honor the imaginative, and spur people's interest in science, medicine, and technology. So let's start out by hearing from one of the past winners of the Ig Nobel Prize. I'm here with Richard Wassersug, professor of anatomy and neurobiology at Dalhousie University. He has a PhD in evolutionary biology from the University of Chicago, and he spent the last 30 years researching the physiology, behavior, and ecology of frogs and toads. As a result, he's one of the most cited authorities on the subject of tadpole biology. Welcome to Speaking Up, Richard.
Hello, Desiree. Thank you for inviting me on the air.
Now, you've obviously written many papers over the years, but today we're going to talk about a particular study that you published in 1971, called On the Comparative Palatability of Some Dry Season Tadpoles from Costa Rica. And that does sound like a Monty Python skit. Please explain.
That's a long time ago. And in fact, I was a graduate student at the time, and I was in a tropical biology course in Costa Rica. And the course ran for 2 months, and at the end, all of us graduate students had to do an independent project. Already starting my PhD on tadpoles. And one of the projects that I could actually find out something new in 3 days. And what I realized from the course, generally when you walk through a jungle, some things are hard to find, hard to see, and may be otherwise benign, that is, not toxic. Certain things are easy to find, easy to see, and usually are pretty noxious or outright toxic. So I thought, since I studied tadpoles, that some tadpoles were easy to find, some tadpoles were really hard to find, and I thought, well, maybe the ones that were easy to find were going to be unpalatable. I mean, tadpoles don't have a lot of other defenses. They don't have spikes and spines and such, so I figured maybe they were unpalatable. And the ones that were difficult to find, I figured maybe palatable. Odd part about the research is that since I only had 3 days, I had to find a predator that I could use or a model organism that would be willing to eat a variety of tadpoles or at least taste them. And that's where the research gets a little weird because there aren't too many available predators that you can actually train to eat tadpoles or condition to eat tadpoles. I found this wasn't as difficult when I decided to just simply offer this opportunity to my fellow graduate students. The incentive was beer. This was the end of the course. A whole bunch of students were willing to sign on, and we had a tadpole tasting session over about a day. It took me about 2 days to round up all the tadpoles. I guess when I look at it now, it does sound a little bit like a Monty Python skit.
So you did conduct this tasting in a way that someone might do a comparative testing on food, say cheese or wine. So can you describe the procedure?
Yes, it was very straightforward. First of all, in case any of the tadpoles were really toxic, I didn't want to kill anybody. So what they're first supposed to do is put the live tadpole in their mouth, let it swim around a little bit. Then they're supposed to nibble on the tail. That's because the tail is basically just thin folds of skin with hardly any other tissue underneath it. So I knew they'd be tasting primarily the skin. And if there was, for instance, silt in the alimentary tract in the intestines of the animal and they chewed on the body right away, they may find it unpleasant. I wouldn't know whether it was because of toxins in the skin or because it was what was there in the gut of the tadpole. So first you just let the tadpole lie on your tongue and move around if you wanted. Then you were supposed to nibble on the tail, and then you were supposed to crunch it up. And I want to point out for the record, at that point you were supposed to then spit it out. And my colleagues are expected to score how unpalatable they were at each stage along the way. And we randomized the tadpoles, so they didn't get them all, perhaps worst tasting one first or last. So actually, in that sense, it was a reasonably well-controlled experiment.
And you did say live. So I do have to ask, could the wriggling have potentially affected their appeal?
Well, that's why they're supposed to put them in the mouth first and, you know, and assess that. I think that most of us can tell whether something is moving in our mouth, so that wasn't a particular problem. I guess one of the things I should say right up front is that this is a type of experiment that I do not recommend anybody do at home or otherwise. I think if we had known how poisonous one of these tadpoles were, I would never even have attempted the experiment.
That's what I was going to ask. You know, given the state of ethics boards now, would this have even passed?
I would say I would never have submitted it. That was a long time ago. You're talking about many decades ago. At that point, we didn't know enough about the animals to appreciate this. But the tadpole that tasted the worst is actually a rather famous frog. It's the cane toad that's invaded Australia. It has tadpoles that form these huge, large, black mats of tadpoles. And part of the success of this frog in invading Australia and a huge part of the rest of the world, it normally lives in Central America and a little bit of South America. It's now in Hawaii. It's been introduced in lots of places by mistake. And because the tadpoles are so toxic and they taste so bad, there are not always a lot of natural predators that will take them on, and consequently they can explode in numbers. All that we didn't know at the time. It would not be appropriate to have people taste things. If we were to do this experiment correctly, you'd want to test the tadpoles in a variety of different animals. Although I should point out that there is a history for showing that humans have a good broad taste profile. And that's actually entertaining in itself, if I can tell you the background. During World War II, the Brits were trying to find a use for some of their senior elderly scientists. And one of the things they organized was the egg tasting panel. These dignified gentlemen were tasting eggs from around the world under the belief that if a British pilot was down to someplace, he might want to know what eggs were edible and what eggs taste badly. And the egg tasting panel did compare their own taste preference against other predators. I think they used either a raccoon or a shrew and other animals as well, and showed that their taste preferences matched that pretty well, these other general omnivorous predators. What they found, though, parallels what I found my tadpoles. Eggs that were found easily, that birds may have laid on the ground, that the pilots could easily find, tasted terrible. Birds' eggs that were on the sides of cliffs and you need sort of ropes or a helicopter to get to them, they tasted okay. So nature had sort of adapted animals which do not have teeth and claw to defend themselves with toxic compounds. And typically, either they hide their eggs in their tadpoles or they put them out in the open, but they make sure they taste really bad. So I was working against that model with my tadpoles, and it turned out to be a valid model.
And this actually wasn't the first study done on the taste of tadpoles, correct?
There have been some studies suggesting that toad tadpoles were unpalatable. So in fact, there's a sad story of a woman in South America who was essentially, her family was starving. She, out of desperation, took some frog's eggs, which are similarly very conspicuous, easy to find, and the toxins are already in the eggs, and there were several deaths, I believe, from the poisoning at that time. We had a hint that some tadpoles had toxic eggs, but we didn't really know that how bad it was until I did my experiment.
Again, the results did match up with your hypothesis.
Yes, the tadpoles that were black and easily seen against the sandy bottoms where they lived, and you could find by the thousands or hundreds of thousands, easy to catch, that you could scoop up with your hands, they were terrible. I got to say, this is many decades ago, and when I think about the worst thing I ever tasted in my life, that was probably that tadpole. Certainly the top two of the worst tasting things I've ever tasted in my life. And the tadpoles that I had to hunt in streams with a tiny little tea strainer and turn over rocks and spend 45 minutes trying to catch a single tadpole, they didn't taste too bad. I mean, I wouldn't say they tasted sweet, but they certainly were neutral, and you knew you were getting some protein if you ate them. The difference was valid.
So does this study have broader implications then? Because it is terribly amusing, I have to say. I giggled my entire way through this.
Yeah, it has a variety of actually valid implications. One is, if we'd known this ahead of time, we might have not introduced the cane toad into Australia 75 years ago. We would have realized that without any natural predators around, this species could increase its numbers extremely rapidly, and that's what happened in Australia. There's one small little footnote in the paper, which hasn't caught a lot of attention, but I actually had to throw out two subjects in my study. This is a warning for those who are still smoking. Those two subjects were smokers. They both essentially, in complete variance from the other subjects, essentially couldn't taste the differences between the tadpoles. And that's some evidence about how evil nicotine is as a defensive compound for the tobacco plant. It blocks the ability to taste. So if somebody actually develops enough of a resistance to the nicotine itself, so that they're perhaps an addict, but at least they're able to eat a tobacco plant, they're not going to be able to taste other poisonous plants or animals. And that's something that's actually only a little footnote in the paper. I've only seen one person, I think, ever notice it there. But it's certainly indirectly a warning that being well adapted to handle toxins in one's diet, one toxin can affect one's insensitivity to other toxins. And it tells us something about the toxic or noxious, unpalatable defenses and the cleverness of natural selection in building chemical defenses against predation.
That is fascinating. Has there been any other studies done on this? Do you know?
Well, since I did that, there's been an enormous number of studies on palatability of tadpoles, but not using humans, again, and for good reason. There's no reason to make humans sick. And we're finding that many other invasive species of frogs have unpalatable tadpoles. One of them is the common bullfrog. It's been introduced on the West Coast. Yeah, it's displacing and wiping out many of the native frogs on the West Coast of North America. That's the problem in Canada and in the United States. I've done other work unrelated to this in Japan. And one of the disturbing aspects is that the American bullfrog was the commonest tadpole I could find in the low-lying areas of both sides of the main island of Honshu. I was collecting tadpoles for experiments on there on how the tadpoles feed. It wasn't an issue about palatability. I was doing an experiment on both sides of the main island of Japan, on Honshu, and I needed just a good general tadpole. I went out into the rice paddies to collect tadpoles, and lo and behold, what I was collecting was the American bullfrog. Well, it turns out its tadpoles are also unpalatable, and it's been a successful invader in a lot of habitats. I think if we had understood this, we would have had better control. Right now, we have a very serious problem with declining and disappearing amphibians from around the world, and in a few places, it appears that it's been human introductions of other species that turned out to have different palatability profiles that have screwed up the environment. I think there are some messages here. We're learning a lot about what tadpoles have as their defenses. This was sort of a starting point for realizing that tadpoles are not just blobs of poorly formed, yet-to-be frogs, but are organisms that have to survive as free-living organisms, and they'll have various defenses. Some of them can change their color and change their toxicity when they are around various predators. One thing that's been learned since then. So this was a fun little study, and I haven't followed up on it. I haven't done more palatability tests, but other people have with looking at interactions between predators in small with the studies. They put it essentially a cattle tank. It's a small artificial environment, but bigger than a lab aquarium. And they're finding that the palatability of tadpoles can really affect the structure of a whole community. So yes, this is research that's relevant. And palatability is something we don't think too much about. All of our food we buy at the grocery store, presumably what we buy is more or less edible. But in nature, being palatable or unpalatable is a very important aspect of the various adaptive and defensive strategies that organisms can have.
Thanks very much for being here, Richard.
Thank you.
And you can find more of Richard's research at anatomy.medicine.dal.ca/wassersug. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Mark Abrams, the editor and co-founder of the science humor magazine, Annals of Improbable Research. He is also the father and MC of the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Desiree. Nice to be here. Thanks.
So let's start off with Improbable Research, the organization. Now, the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony is probably your most widely known project, but that's definitely not the only thing you do.
Yeah, I do a few other things. They all have something in common. They're all about things, and it also took me a few years to figure out how to describe this in a phrase. The phrase is things that make people laugh and then make them think. So that's what the Ig Nobel Prizes are about. They're for great achievements, or maybe not so great achievements, that make people laugh and then make them think. And that's what the magazine is all about. So the range of things you're asking about. There's the magazine, the Annals of Improbable Research, comes out every 2 months. It's also on the internet. There's a little monthly newsletter. There's lots of stuff every day on the website. And there's also a newspaper column every week in one of the British newspapers.
And you also have a YouTube channel.
And we have a YouTube channel. We've been making some little 3-minute videos for the last year or two of all sorts of things. So they're experiments in different ways to show people things that make them laugh and make them think, we hope.
Well, that can fairly be described as a multimedia empire, can it not?
The multimedia, I guess, yeah. The empire sounds like a pretty grand word.
Well, how do you find enough content to support all that?
Just looking around at the world. There's an awful lot of stuff going out there right in front of everybody that seems normal once you if you move to a new neighborhood or you get a new job or you go to school and you begin studying something, everything is strange and odd, and a lot of it's pretty funny the first few days, and then you get used to it. So we try to not get used to things, and as we've gotten a little better known every year around the world, more people notice things on their own and send them in to us.
Is there really that much odd or amusing science going on?
Yeah. Name me some things that are not odd, please.
That's actually a good point, depending on perspective.
Yeah.
So are most of the studies things that you find on your own?
At this point, there are a lot of things we find, and we as a big group of people, it's the editors of the magazine and readers and on, and this is scattered around the world. You know, thanks to the Internet, it's now easy to be in touch with our far-flung gang every day all over the place. But by now, there's a flood of stuff coming in every single day, from mostly from people we don't know. Some of it from people that we do know, have gotten to know over the years. It's pretty steady, but mostly it's just people we don't know sending in things we've never dreamed about.
Well, how often do researchers contact you about their own work?
Fairly often. You know, there are some people who see their own stuff. Say, every once in a while, they'll step back and look at what they're doing and think, you know, if I were not doing this, I would think this is pretty amusing. And there are a lot of people who get dismayed that no matter what it is they're doing, nobody seems to notice very much. And the cure for that, especially if you think you're doing something that's worthwhile, is maybe try to look at it with somebody else's eyes. See how it looks to somebody who doesn't know all the detail you know. And sometimes that means it's more interesting just because it's different and it's kind of strange. It's not something you're used to.
What kind of response do you get from scientists when they find out that their research is part of one of your projects or that you're covering it?
It varies quite a bit. You know, mostly if I write a newspaper column about somebody, typically I'll just try to write a column based on what they've done, you know, what I can read, their published work or something, and try to be clear about that. Occasionally, if it's something where I can't make sense of it, but it seems that it has that funny quality, I might get in touch with them and ask for more details. And often I hear nothing. Often I'll hear afterwards that they were fairly happy. Once in a great while, somebody's a little unhappy, but that really hasn't happened very much. The complaints tend to be, and I'm always surprised at how rare they are, they tend to be from people who are doing things that really are not at all scientific, but the people doing them think they're scientific.
Can I have an example?
No, because those are the people who call up very angry and threaten to sue and to intensify from there. They never do, but some people tend to get very upset whenever anybody says anything about them that's not in exactly the phrasing that they want it said.
Right.
Scientists, for the most part, are not like that. I'm very happy to say, although occasionally there are some.
Have you ever been asked to completely remove a study from the site?
Oh, yeah. Not very often, and we don't.
Oh, interesting.
You know, we would, certainly if we've made a mistake on something, if we're describing something and we're, you know, mischaracterizing it, then, yeah, of course we'll fix it or remove it or something, but that doesn't happen too often. You know, we do occasionally make some mistakes, but if it's just that we've described something accurately and somebody doesn't like the fact that now somebody's noticed what they're doing, well, too bad.
And you've never been sued?
I have been sued once, but over nothing at all connected to this. It was something that just made no sense whatsoever, and it eventually got thrown out of court, sort of gleefully by the court system, but it did take a long time.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Mark Abrams about improbable research. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So you must have written about hundreds of stories at this point. So do you have a favorite?
I have many favorites. How about if I just pick a few of the Ig Nobel Prize winners and describe some of those to you?
Oh, let's save the Ig Nobels for later. I have a whole lot of questions about those. I'm thinking what you cover specifically in the Annals of Improbable Research.
Well, there's just overlap. You know, it's also for I'm sure you and anybody who does something every day or every week, whatever, you're always working on the next few things. And the moment you finish something, it's now in the past. So your mind is always a little bit ahead. And if somebody asks you, hey, what about that thing that just got published last week? You know, the dim, deep past, and it takes a while to remember what that was.
So it's not for sure that if you end up in the Annals of Improbable Research that you're going to go on to the nomination process, let's say.
Process of the Ig Nobel Prize? Mm-hmm. Well, I think just by being alive, you're fair game for being nominated. Anybody can send in. Let me talk about the Ig Nobel Prizes a little bit in general. So they are for things, any kind of things, that make people laugh and then make them think. A lot of them turn out to be related to science or technology or medicine, but it can be anything else. And we give out a Peace Prize every year, a Literature Prize most year, Economics Prize. We've given out Ig Nobel Prizes in the field of art. For example, the guy who invented the plastic pink flamingo back in the 1950s won the Ig Nobel Art Prize for doing that. The art prize was given another year. We've only given it probably a handful of times. It was given one year to some children in France in the equivalent of Boy Scouts who went to an old cave and they were asked to clean up all of the graffiti on the side of the cave, which they did, and then afterwards learned that was the stuff they had removed from that cave very carefully were some of the oldest known cave paintings.
Oof.
So that seemed worth an Ig Nobel Prize.
It says on the site that the prize is awarded for achievements that cannot or should not be reproduced.
That's how we described it the first few years, and that was the short version. The full version was it cannot be reproduced, maybe because if you're the very first person to do something, nobody else can legitimately claim that firstness. They might say it, but it's not true. If you were the first one, nobody else can be the first. But after a few years, we figured out this other phrase that covers that and more stuff. It's that it makes people laugh and then makes them think. So the first time you run across it, whatever it is, you almost have no choice. You know, it's funny. And then a few days later, you find walking around, it's still banging away in your head. And really, all you want to do is call up two or three of your friends and tell them about it and find out what they think about it.
Well, where did the idea for the prize come from in the first place?
About 20 years ago, I became the editor of a science magazine, and I discovered that if that happens to you, you will start meeting all kinds of people you had never dreamed of. And some of them had done things that were pretty funny, and some of those funny things were pretty wonderful, and some were pretty terrible, but they were all pretty funny, and it seemed just a shame that almost nobody ever knew about these things. It seemed like these people had done these things and it would just vanish from history. No one would know. So it seemed like a nice thing to have some kind of little honor for the people who've done things that especially grab your attention if you notice them.
So why is it so valuable, this idea of making people laugh and then think?
Who says it's valuable?
Well, you do have an entire organization built on this one sentence, so I'm just going to assume. But do you think it's valuable?
Well, it is to me. I make no claims for whether this is important or not, but it's. I like to think that it's in general a good thing to do things that pique people's curiosity. There are an awful lot of things that people probably would care about and be intensely curious about, but they. They have no good reason to spend more than an eighth of a second looking at them. So that's a big part of what we're about, just trying to catch people's attention so they'll spend, you know, a tenth of a second, or instead of an eighth, two-eighths of a second, a quarter of a second looking at this stuff and thinking about it, and maybe it will grab their attention.
So would you say that you're hoping to encourage people to be curious then?
Yeah, that's our noblest goal, is to make people develop a little bit more the habit of being curious about things that they don't know anything about.
So not necessarily just about science specifically then?
Yeah, to me anyway, there's no very firm border at all between things that are called science and everything else.
We have a question from the chat room.
How do you distinguish between valid papers that are weird and research that is just bad? Do you try to make that distinction clear?
Is the chat room person there? Can I ask a question back to clarify this?
Why not?
Sure. Valid paper. What do they mean by valid paper? What's valid?
You know, I'm going to speak for the chat room person.
Okay.
I'm thinking that what they mean by valid paper is something that would be printed in an academic journal.
And what does that mean? There's all kinds of wonderful stuff printed in academic journals, and there's all kinds of absolute pure garbage. The fact that something's printed in a journal doesn't really tell you anything about it.
Agreed. So how about something with what would widely be considered a valid methodology?
Oh, you're using big words here.
Sorry, love.
Well, just translate it, though, into you know, plain language. So I'm not trying to give you a hard time,
mm-hmm.
but I want to, if I give you an answer, I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
So let's say a study that uses, let's say, double blinding, that has a reasonable sample size, that is peer reviewed.
Okay, well, those are all technical terms you're using, and by themselves, you know, each of those are nice ideas, but in doing, you know, a study or an experiment or whatever, the basic idea generally should be to try to answer some question. You know, I'm going to look at something where nobody is quite sure whether it's this way or that way. You know, whether this is the way nature works or that way or some other way. We just don't know, so we're going to try to find out. And there are lots of ways to do that, I mean, depending on what the question is, but there are usually lots of ways to you know, to skin a cat, as the old saying goes. And some of them involve all kinds of technical machinery around yourself, including peer review and this and that, and some of them are just doing something very, very simple. Some of the experiments that scientists really think of as the very best experiments don't have a whole lot of that, you know, scientifical kind of machinery around them. They're just, somebody looked at something in such a simple, clear way that when they were done, anybody else could look at what they did and look at their description and see that, yeah, it's very clear now that this is the way nature is. And it's very clear that it doesn't work in the opposite way. But it really depends on the things. You know, you meet somebody on the street, and they come up to you and they tell you something, say, about, you know, the building that's across the street, you know, about what's going on in that building. And they can give you all kinds of technical detail and tell you how they found out. You still don't know. You're taking it on faith from them. And a formal scientific study is no different than that. Even though it's written down there, in the end, it's up to you to decide, do I believe what they told me? And before I make that decision, whether I believe it or not, is there something I can do to check up a little bit so I have some idea whether I should trust this person and trust what they're writing here?
So this is interesting to me. Now, who's your primary audience? Because it sounds like scientists are not.
From what I can tell, our readers span a huge range. A lot of them are scientists. A lot of them pretty clearly don't normally go anywhere near science. But I think what most of them seem to have in common is they really get kind of curious about a little more, you know, more kinds of things than most people do. And they're kind of intrigued about figuring out how they want to think about things, how they want to decide what's true and what's not when somebody tells them something.
We often hear about science having sort of a PR problem, especially in your country.
Everybody's got a PR problem.
So do you think there are any lessons here at all?
Much of what scientists do is try to answer questions and try to make sense of things that nobody has ever quite managed to figure out. So most of what they're doing is trying to figure out stuff that is tough. You know, so often that means it'll take you more than half a minute to explain what this thing is. And the PR problem, in a way, just comes from that, you know, in a world where everybody has 50 million things every day that they could choose to look at. Do you want to spend more than a couple of seconds on something, trying to make sense of something you've never run across? Do you want to look, if you're looking on a website or in a newspaper or on TV, do you want to look at more than a headline or not? And in a world where a lot of people have been encouraged and almost trained to just look at a headline and decide yes or no, that's the truth or not, and that's the end of the story, anything a little more complicated is tough. So, yeah, a scientist who's doing something that's slightly complicated is going to have a PR problem. Just as if you try to explain to some stranger down the street, say, something that's going on in your family, there are a few things you could explain easily. Oh, we're moving to Winnipeg tomorrow. That's easy to explain. But other stuff usually takes more than a sentence or two. Same with scientists. Most of what they're doing takes more than a sentence or two.
So then do you think that using humor to try and make science more accessible is more effective than serious methods?
I wouldn't say by itself it is, but as one more way of having discussions with people, yeah, because if somebody is going to find something funny, it means they're going to stop for a second and think about it. You know, it's got your attention. And that by itself puts it, makes it a rare kind of thing. Okay, it's something that's actually caught your attention. You're stopping, and now you're thinking about it. And all around you every day, there's so many things happening that you can't pay attention to everything. But now you've laughed at it, and you want to know more. At least for the next few seconds, you want to know more. So I think that can be very helpful to people.
Well, is there ever any concern or criticism that you're trivializing science?
Sure. Especially from people who don't even know what I'm doing. but there's not a whole lot of that. Just as the Ig Nobel Prizes, in the early days, we would get a lot of criticism about that from people who didn't know anything more than that we were giving out prizes, and it was something to do with often with science and funny. And so a lot of people, knowing only that, assumed, oh, these guys are attacking scientists. They're ridiculing scientists. And that's not what we're doing. Some of the things we write about may, if you read it, you may well decide this is something that's utterly foolish and that kind of ridiculous, and you may be correct. But we're not going to say that, and we're not going to try to slant it. If something is that way, then if anyone describes it clearly, that's how it's going to strike people. All we try to do is describe things clearly, and we try to limit ourselves to things that happen to be pretty funny. So if it's something that happens to be pretty funny and it's really good, great, then it'll make people laugh and they'll look at it and maybe they'll decide, hey, that's pretty good. If it's something that makes people laugh and it's something that's really pretty awful, terrible thing for the world, maybe they're going to laugh at it and then they're going to think, yeah, it's funny and, oh, that's a terrible thing. But we don't concentrate on just the one or just the other or just on the stuff that's in between. To us, it's kind of an interesting world. Bring up all this stuff and let people decide on their own whether a particular thing is good or bad or important or not.
And we have a question from the website.
Is there a risk of improbable research being held up as one of those look at the useless crap scientists are studying statements that politicians make? Sarah Palin recently mentioned fruit fly research as an example when she was campaigning, and that was actually valuable research, and that's from Mike.
Well, anybody who wants to just hold up anything, to take anything out of context, it's possible to ridicule absolutely anything, and it's very easy to do. And there have probably throughout the whole history of humanity, there have been people who made their careers doing that. And in politics, again, through the whole history of humanity, there have been politicians who thrive doing that. Nothing's going to stop that. That's the way humans seem to be, some of us. But, that shouldn't stop the rest of the world from going on. If all you care about is whether there's some jerk who's going to take what you're doing out of context and make you try to look like a fool, well, it's going to happen no matter what.
We have a clarification on that previous question from the chat room.
For instance, the first year they gave a prize to someone who had convinced himself that water had memory. Is that not distinct from research that is supportable scientifically?
That was a French scientist named Jacques Benveniste, who was, from everything that we know throughout much of his career, up to a point anyway, he was a very respected scientist in his field, respected by the other scientists in his field. And then he started doing some things that maybe changed that. And he published a paper which explained that in his view, and with what he said was evidence, that water molecules are able to remember what happened to them. And he managed to get this published in what might be the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, Nature. You know, there are two big journals in the world. One's called Nature, the other's called Science. And scientists really, some of them would kill to get one of their papers published there during a lifetime. You know, sometimes you can almost make your career in a way by just getting one thing published. And he managed to get that published. Right after it came out, the people who run Nature decided they had made a horrible mistake. And this became a great, great cause of amusement throughout the science world. What more to say about that?
And we have another question from the chat room.
Many of the studies given the Ig Nobel Prize are well-designed and even important. Do you worry that readers will automatically dismiss findings because of the award? And that's from Barbara Drescher.
Well, again, you know, we our criterion and we try to hammer home is simply something makes people laugh and then makes them think. And when we choose, we give 10 prizes a year. We've been doing this since 1991, so we're about to give out the 20th set of Ig Nobel Prizes. And in almost every case, not quite every, but almost every case, when we choose somebody or choose a team to receive an Ig Nobel Prize, we call them up very quietly, and we give them the chance to decline the honor if they want. And if they say they don't want it, then that's the end of it. You know, we never, ever mention it, and it's gone. Very few people ever turn it down. It's you know, it happens, but it's fairly rare that happens. And when people win the Ig Nobel Prizes, we invite them to come to the ceremony. We have a big ceremony out here in Massachusetts at Harvard University, the biggest auditorium at Harvard, biggest classroom also. It's an old stately building called Sanders Theater. And it's always filled with 1,200 people, and press come from around the world. We webcast it live. It'll be on YouTube this year. And there are a bunch of famous scientists, Nobel laureates, who come, who are part of the ceremony, and they shake the hands of these Ig Nobel winners, and everybody seems pretty pleased about it. And some of them have done things that are, you know, slightly, they have a tinge of foolishness to them, but maybe a tinge of genius as well. Some of them just, you know, something unfortunate happened, but hey, it's interesting. Some of them did things that, hey, might even be pretty valuable and also happen to be funny. And an awful lot of them, it's really impossible to say. And as time's gone on, as the years have gone on, more and more of the winners, it seems every year, kind of like that mixed thing. You know, that's kind of like life. And a lot of things in the history of science that got looked on as unimportant or even, you know, pretty foolish turned out 10 years later or two lifetimes later to be extremely important. Only nobody really recognized that at the time. So at least the one thing I can claim for sure that we're doing is bringing a little bit of attention to a lot of people.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about improbable research with Mark Abrams. Email us live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more improbable research after the break.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by neuroscientist and musician Daniel Levitin to discuss his book, This Is Your Brain on Music. We'll look at the neuroscience of music appreciation and explore the fascinating ways that listening to music affects our brains. And on Speaking Up, artist Raven Hanna and project manager Logan Daniel share a look at the Science Tarot, a project that uses eye-catching art and the mythical structure of the tarot to illuminate scientific concepts. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with Mark Abrams, the father and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize. We were talking about the nominations for the prize, and those are completely open, correct?
Correct. Anybody can send in a nomination. And something that's been happening more and more, and started fairly early, is that after a few of the early winners got lots of publicity that was really spread all over the place, we started finding that people's institutions were nominating them. You know, if somebody worked in a company, the company would nominate one of their employees and push really hard to get to get an Ig Nobel Prize for them. Somebody's university would push hard. Somebody's hospital, if they're a doctor and work in a hospital. Even occasionally, we've had governments push hard to get Ig Nobel Prizes for some of their people. We really didn't expect that would happen.
How many submissions do you get each year, then?
We get, typical year, 6,000, 7,000, maybe a little more than that. And then whatever does not get selected, again, we pick just 10 a year, goes back into the pool. So now, after 20 years, the pool is pretty big.
So how do you whittle them down to the 10 winners, then?
It's not easy. It's really not easy. One thing we try to do early on is, you know, look at the basic things. If it doesn't make anybody laugh, then it's not going to go anywhere. And also, if it's just funny, but it doesn't really make you start to wonder about something, that's not going to go anywhere. If it does both, then we start looking at it harder, and we also start looking harder about whether the person really exists and whether they really did the thing that somebody's telling us they did. You know, we work very hard now to make sure all these things are real, and when we announce the winners, we put up information on our website and send them out to press around the world, telling you exactly where you can go to find more information.
But the awards aren't actually limited to research, correct?
No. No, not limited to anything except what's real.
So then how do you go about making sure that the studies you find interesting actually exist?
Well, if we can't see a copy of them, they don't exist, as far as we're concerned. You know, if they don't exist in a way where we can find them and see them, and we can point to anybody else where they can go and find them and see them, then sorry, that's not going to get a prize.
Well, the first year you gave the Education Prize to American Vice President Dan Quayle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he exists.
Right. but he was given the prize for demonstrating better than anyone else the need for science education. So
that's
what
right.
What did he do? We're in Canada. So.
Yeah, well, and for some of the figures that are widely known in the press and easy to find yourself simply by, in those days, going to a newspaper, but now Googling. It's easy to look that up if you want. He was making all kinds of statements. Again, I've got 20 years of these things in my head, and it's not easy to pull out the details for each and every one of them. But if you Google Dan Quayle, Quayle, and science, you will come up with a long, long, long list of statements that will make you laugh and make you think. And this man was the Vice President of the United States, and he was chairman of the United States National Space Council, you know, a body that was supposed to, in some sense, guide and oversee the whole plan for the future of exploring space. And look up those statements, and you'll learn something.
Did he accept?
In those days, in the early years, you know, when you start something, you have a generally pretty good idea of what it is, but still, the details, you figure out some of them as you're going along. In the early years, especially the first year, it just did not occur to us that we should invite every winner and that they might all come. So we did not invite all of the winners. And unfortunately, we didn't invite him. It would have been nice if he'd come.
I also noticed that you choose a random passerby to assist you on the last day of deliberations.
Yeah, we like to introduce some balance into this.
What do you do? You go out onto the street?
Usually, yeah.
Have these people heard of the Ig Nobels?
Some of them.
So you actually have people come in off the street to judge a contest that
potentially they have no idea. If they look hostile, if when we ask them to come in, they look like they're going to hit us, then we don't have them come in, but we'll get somebody else.
Do you get random people sort of camping out outside, hoping to be the random passerby?
No, because we hold meetings in different places and different times, and that's always a very, 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 very low-key, quiet thing.
Well, we started out the show talking to Dr. Richard Wassersug, who won the Ig Nobel for Biology in 2000, and that was for a study he did in the 70s that compared the taste of different species of Costa Rican tadpoles.
Yes. Now, when you heard about that for the first time, what was your reaction?
I laughed honestly, while reading his study, I laughed for a good 15 minutes.
And over the next few days, did you tell anybody about it?
Absolutely.
Ah, so now you see he qualified quite well as a nominee. And that study was hard not to give a prize to. You know, that one, I think, was destined to win an Ig Nobel Prize. You know, what more to say about that?
Well, what are some of your, I guess, the most interesting to you, the winners of the Ig Nobel?
Well, there are lots of them. I'll pick them somewhat at random. There was, it's called a beautiful piece of work done by a man named Troy Hurtubise, who lives in North Bay, Ontario. Troy spent, at the time we'd given him the prize, something like 7 years building and personally testing a suit of armor that he hoped would protect him against grizzly bears.
I think I remember that one.
Yeah. There was a documentary film made by the National Film Board of Canada, in fact, called Project Grizzly. And Troy, from early on, had some of his friends and collaborators bring video cameras, and they recorded a lot of this. And so the documentary makers took a lot of those and then filmed some of their own and followed Troy around and put them together. So you can see this. And in fact, the National Film Board, a year or two ago, I think, put that whole film up on the Internet for free. So you can go to their website and watch this. And most people find it utterly mesmerizing. I almost think anybody would find it mesmerizing. You know, you see Troy in this suit of armor, which he clearly has built from scrounge materials for the most part. The early version was made from old discarded hockey suits, and then he kept adding things. And you see video of Troy in these suits, which over the years got bulkier and bulkier, being pushed over the side of a cliff. You see the big hulking guys with baseball bats who are told to attack him, and they do. You see him standing in the middle of an open field. And then you see a Jeep coming in from one side at, I think, 40 miles an hour and ram into him, and much more. It's it makes you think.
Just so you know, you have an entire studio of people here who are trying not to laugh into their microphones.
Troy also, I'm just giving you a shorthand version. That's just the beginning of the story of Troy. And that's pretty similar for an awful lot of people who've won Ig Nobel Prizes, that when you read the description of what they did, or you hear one of us tell about it, or you hear somebody else tell about it, and you're getting a sentence or maybe half a minute or something, often that's just the beginning. Just as you saw with Richard Wassersug, you can hear that he did a taste test of different kinds of tadpoles. That's just the beginning of the story, and it gets better and better as you learn more and more details, and it takes you in lots of directions.
Well, last year you gave the prize for public health to Dr. Bodnar for something called the emergency bra.
That's a story that's continuing to unfold. Dr. Elena Bodnar, who for the past 20 years or so has been in Chicago, she's originally from Ukraine, and she invented a brassiere that, in an emergency, can be quickly converted into a pair of protective face masks. One to protect your own life, and the other to save the life of some needy bystander.
That is very responsible.
That's the way many people look at it. I'll begin to give you the richer version of the story. When she was a young doctor in the Ukraine, she treated a lot of people who had been harmed in the wake of the Chernobyl power plant disaster. And she said that the doctors there learned after a couple of years that much of the medical difficulty, much of the damage came from what people had breathed in, things that got into their lungs. And so she was ever since then, she was thinking that if only there had been some simple mask, it wouldn't have to be elaborate, even just, you know, a good piece of cloth that was handy that people could have put over their mouths and noses, then there'd be an awful lot more people that were healthy that wouldn't have suffered the terrible harm. And so she, years later, she thought, she looked around her and she realized most parts of the world, if you go out in public or you're in a room somewhere, you look around, about half the people in the room are wearing bras, which are made of material, and most of those bras, the material in it is, you know, it might not do an absolutely perfect job, but it'll do most of the job pretty well. And for, you know, a couple of minutes or a couple hours, that could save your life.
This is brilliant. It is one of my favorite inventions ever.
If you go to our website, there's video up there, a very short video of her acceptance speech at the ceremony last year, when she, in a minute, explained what this was, and then she reached inside the cleavage of her gown, pulled out her bra, and then she had several Nobel laureates standing next to her, and she used them to demonstrate. So you unclasp this in the front and the back, so it comes quickly, two cups, each of them has straps. And so she took her bra out, separated it into two pieces, put one of them over the face of one Nobel laureate, put the other half over the face of another Nobel laureate. Then she reached inside her bra, inside her dress again, pulled out a second bra. She said, you know, on occasions like this, you'll want to have a second bra. And separated that, put the third cup on the face of another Nobel laureate, put the fourth cup over her own face, took a bow, and sat down. And all that within 2 minutes. That's not the end of the story either, because she's coming back. We're having this year's Ig Nobel ceremony next week, next Thursday night. It's going to be, you know, anyone can watch it free live on YouTube. She's coming back here, and she's holding a press conference Tuesday morning at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where she's going to announce, well, I guess I sort of am at the moment, that the bra is now available for purchase by the public. And she's got a website, and she's going to demonstrate it. And she's also going to announce something else there, which is, and explain, that she's got a new invention. It's a counterpart of that same invention, but this new one is designed for men to wear.
Please, sir, tell me this is a jockstrap face mask.
I have agreed not to discuss this in public before the press conference.
You know, if there is anybody listening who is not going to be watching the Ustream of this ceremony, I just don't know what's wrong with you people.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we have something like 7 or 8 past Ig Nobel winners who are coming back to the ceremony, and then 10 new ones. I'll mention a few of the past winners who are coming back. Dr. Bodnar is coming back. The Dutch scientist who published the first scientifically documented account of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck, he's coming. Dr. Francis Fesmire is coming. Dr. Fesmire is the doctor who discovered the first reliable cure for what's called intractable hiccups. That's the hiccups that, you know, won't stop for weeks and months. And his method of treating it, apparently quite effective, is called digital rectal massage.
I have no appropriate follow-up question for that.
I'm sure you'll think of one.
Oh, this is a fantastic organization and idea, really.
Oh, well,
because just
yeah.
So you know, you have 4 people in the studio who are
you.
Dying.
Well, I do
right
want to
now.
Urge you guys and anyone listening, go to the website and just look over the list of winners. And there, who knows, there may be some people there you know. At improbable.com, and if for everybody, if you ever run across, you know, after you look down the list, you'll get a feel for the, you know, the flavor of these things, which again is just makes you laugh and then it makes you think. And if you ever run across something especially outstanding in that way, let us know. Just drop us a note.
We only have a few minutes left of the show, but I do have to mention Miss Sweetie Poo.
Yeah, Miss Sweetie Poo. That's I think maybe our own best invention. At the Ig Nobel ceremony, we have lots of people who have to give speeches. You know, 10 new Ig Nobel winners. We let the returning past winners each say a few words. We have some Nobel laureates who are each going to say some things. We also have a little opera we write every year about something in science and a bunch of other stuff. And we try to do this all within 90 minutes, which is seemingly impossible. So we have to make everything happen really quickly. And we, for years, tried to come up with some good way to keep everybody's speeches truly short. You know, you've had to probably sit through so many ceremonies where everybody drones on a little too much. And what we finally came up with that works is we find every year a very cute 8-year-old girl. And it has to be an 8-year-old girl who has very unusual quality, sort of ice water in her veins. And this little 8-year-old girl sits on one side of the stage, and I introduce her at the start of the night. And I explain, this is Miss Sweetie Poo. Whenever Miss Sweetie Poo feels that somebody has talked long enough, she'll let them know. And I ask her to demonstrate. So she, this little girl, walks all the way across the stage up to the person who's talking, and she looks up at that person and she says, please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. And it works.
I would assume.
We took recently, we went back through a lot of the video from past Ig Nobel ceremonies, and we took out some of the highlights, some of the best moments from the various Miss Sweetie Poos, and put them together. If you go to our website, to the webpage that describes this year's ceremony, you can see that. And we're very proud of those girls.
Well, on that note, I am absolutely not bored, but we are still out of time.
Well, thank you very much for having me on tonight.
Absolutely. And again, where and when can people go to watch the ceremony?
Go to our website, improbable.com. There'll be a link to our YouTube page, or you can go to YouTube and just search for Improbable Research, and it will be this coming Thursday night, September 28th. It starts about 7:15 Boston, Massachusetts time. So that will be, what, about 5:15 your time?
About that.
And it will, if we do it well, it'll last, you know, under 2 hours, if Miss Sweetie Poo is in good form.
Thank you so much for being here, Mark, especially during, I know, what is a ridiculously hectic time for you.
Yeah, well, pleasure. Thanks again, and good luck.
And we are, as always, at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, to our past episodes, and to iTunes. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
And now I have a question for all of you. Our lovely host station, CJSR, will be holding their annual fundraising campaign, Fund Drive, from October 27th to November 6th. So the two Skeptically Speaking episodes that you'll hear within that time frame are the ones where we'll be asking you for money. So heads up. On one of those episodes, we'll be doing a retrospective of some of the most memorable moments from the show. And since we already know which bits we loved, we want to know your favorites. So if there was a particular point in a specific show that caused a minor epiphany, or made you spit coffee on your keyboard, or caused you to laugh out loud at a totally inappropriate time, do let us know. We'll include as many of those as we can in that episode. Send your ideas to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com and put best of in the subject line. Thanks all. We appreciate your continued support.
The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online. Reading tarot cards and witches, psychics. And their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams. The charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus. Eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is recorded live at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Michael Harrison manages our electronic communications. The soundboard is run by Ryan Bromsgrove. Lisa Skovanek is our assistant studio technician. Post-production editing and additional research by K.O. Myers. Our theme song is written and recorded by AOK, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell.